Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is the Wheel of Time.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 50 of the Fourth Age, Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com.
Hi, of course, I'm Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here as usual, and with us for this episode we also have Amir. Hi, Amir.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Wheel of Time podcast. This evening we'll be discussing some exciting news from DragonMount and Tor Publishing.
And our trusty website host from DragonMount.com, Jason.
And though it might not be something that we would normally say in this kind of instance, there is always, in the Fourth Age, a chance for spoilers. Probably not, but just in case, you've been warned.
And this is the last warning you'll get for this episode. That's it. You're done. If we spoil it, we spoil it.
So, as most of our listeners probably know by now, there have been some developments with the release of The Gathering Storm, the latest book in the Wheel of Time series. Jason, the administrator and host and founder of DragonMount.com, actually got a sneak peek and actually read the arc of The Gathering Storm, and he has posted a book review on DragonMount.com, which we will read parts of.
I'm really jealous because Jason got to read this months in advance. July 30th, he said, "I have read The Gathering Storm." And that is just a phrase that would strike chills into the heart of any Wheel of Time fan who would give their eye teeth and probably many other body parts or anything else they possessed in order to read this book right now rather than later. And I'm one of them. So I was just so excited to see that he was actually able to get that. And the reason for that is because Jason's been a friend of the Jordan family, well, actually the Rigney family, for quite some time and considered himself honored to be called Robert Jordan's friend. And he's still close to Harriet and Brandon. So one of the perks of having such wonderful connections is that he got to read this way early.
As soon as I saw that headline, I wanted to, number one, kill him, number two, steal his copy. I was so jealous.
Yeah, I was pretty green myself. I don't know about killing him, but I definitely wanted to go see if I could raid his pad.
No offense, Jason. It's just...
We love you, Jason, but why are we jealous? Why are we jealous?
So before he actually begins his review, Jason says, before, in this case, you read my review, I need to give you full disclosure. It's important to remember my point of view. I'm running a large fan site for a book series that is very near and dear to my heart. Over the years, I came to know Robert Jordan, and I am proud to have him call me friend. I'm close to Harriet, his widow, as well as other members of his family and staff. I consider Brandon Sanderson to be my friend, as long as he lets me win a few Magic the Gathering games anyway. I'm affiliated with Tor Books, Robert Jordan's U.S. publisher, via personal relationships, small business deals, and as of recently, their website, Tor.com, for which I occasionally blog. That said, I have not ever accepted money or other payment from them to promote, endorse, or write nice things about their Wheel of Time products. So, with that in mind, I will tell you truthfully, my review below is for you, the reader who wants the truth and not the hype. I am not here to sell you the book. I am here to tell you, as one fan to another, what you can expect from this new installment in the Wheel of Time series. While the facts of my disclosure above will never make me completely neutral, I promise you that my primary responsibility and obligation remains, as always, to give it to you straight. Like you, I am a fan first and foremost. Okay, we good to go? All set? Then here we go.
So Jason goes on to write, "The Gathering Storm is, in my opinion, quite easily one of the most intense and exciting books in the entire Wheel of Time series." Yes, you read that right. I avoided writing this review right after I finished reading. Instead, I purposely waited some time to let the initial rush and enjoyment wear off. It has certainly cooled a great deal, but I can still say with grounded and sober confidence that the book is outstanding. I would rank it up there in the top four in the series, along with The Shadow Rising, The Fires of Heaven, and The Great Hunt. Pacing-wise, I would agree with Brandon Sanderson's statement that it's similar to books 4 through 6 in the series. Again, warning, minor spoilers ahead. Skip down a bit if you don't want to read them. Well, we're not. We're going to just read them. So, you had your spoiler alert. The story brings focus back to the characters that need it, most notably Rand. Last we had seen the poor guy, he had built up a thick stone wall against his emotions, had his hand blown off, and was nearly blinded by one of the Forsaken. That would have been Semirog. On his blog, Robert Jordan described Rand in a situation like this. The world and the forces of light are in bad shape. At this point, boys and girls, the shadow is winning. There are glimmers of hope, but only glimmers, and they must pay off for the light to win. All the shadow needs for victory is for matters to keep on as they have been going thus far, and one or two of those glimmers to fade or be extinguished. The forces of the light are on the ropes, and they don't even know everything the Dark One has up his sleeve. Think of it this way. The bell is about to ring for the 15th round, and the light is so far behind on points the only way to win is a knockout. Our boy is game, but he's wobbly on his legs and bleeding from cuts over his eyes. Now he has 3 minutes to pull out his best stuff and deliver the punch of his life. The Dark One has taken a few shots, but nothing that has really damaged him. He's still dancing on his toes and talking trash. His headshots can fracture a skull, and his body punches can break ribs, and now he's ready to unveil his surprises. You didn't think all it would take is for Rand to show up at the last battle, did you? According to the prophecies, the light has no chance without him, but his presence doesn't ensure victory, just that the light has a chance. Gotta stiffen your legs and blink the blood out of your eyes. Gotta suck it up and find that punch. 3 minutes to go, and you gotta find that knockout. That's your only chance. If you thought Rand was hard before, you haven't seen anything yet. As I read this new book, my heart just went out to him. I was completely engaged as I witnessed him go deeper and deeper into depression and insanity. We've all known that Rand has been going the wrong way emotionally for a long time. But in this new novel, Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson took him to a place I never thought he would go. There is a scene toward the middle of the book that was so dramatic and intense that I don't even know how to say it. As a longtime fan of the novels, it rocked me to read it. I had to set the book down and let it soak in. Remember the intensity of Dumais Wells at the end of Lord of Chaos? This is like that, minus the armies. I am certain that in the years ahead, we'll run polls on Dragonmount for the best scenes in the series, and this will be one of the popular choices. Trust me, you'll know it when you read it.
I'll continue here. It's not just about one exciting scene, though. Every single chapter is well-written, and most of them are totally engaging. Though, to be fair, the chapters I'm thinking of which weren't usually featured Gawain, and I was more annoyed with him than anything else. I suppose you could argue that I was engaged in wanting to smack that character. But then again, there was that one chapter where he, well, did some cool sword stuff. That was certainly engaging. The point is that this isn't a book where you slug through pages for a dozen chapters, read an exciting part, and then have to dig through another 10. This is far more evened out, with carefully crafted arcs that begin and end within the confines of this single volume. There are dozens of intense or exciting scenes scattered throughout. By the end of the prologues, Fan will be chattering away. By the time you get to Matt's adventures to a certain location, I'm not saying a thing about where that might be, the theory forums and theorland.com will be bursting at the seams. Whereas I loved every chapter devoted to Rand, easily half the book, if not more, it was Egwene who stole the show for me. To describe what she goes through, what's revealed to her, and what she chooses to do in the end would be far too spoilerish to get into. But suffice to say that it was dynamic and highly enjoyable. I confess that I had a lot of fun going through all of the online theories related to her and the White Tower, reading them and being able to separate the ones that turned out to be accurate from the ones that weren't. There weren't very many wholly accurate ones. In fact, none. Most of the main characters are present in this novel and have at least one or two chapters from their point of view. At least one is completely absent, but I'll let you debate who it is, just like I'll let you try and interpret who the main characters are. Oh, and regarding Asmodian? RAFO. Ha! I always wanted to do that. And finally, as Harriet told us at JordanCon, I can confirm that there are not one but two climaxes at the end of this book. Big ones. Both are events we've been waiting for a long time. That's the end of the spoilers, folks, though I don't really think those were spoilers.
So, now, the other burning question. Does this feel like a Robert Jordan novel? Does it have his voice? Well, truthfully, I thought the prose stayed very true to previous novels, but ultimately you're going to be the judge on that. Brandon Sanderson has gone on record several times saying that he is not trying to mimic Robert Jordan's voice, that doing so would just be parody. What he set out to do, and what I think he accomplished, was to tap into that font of story and events in the universe that previously had been experienced and documented by Robert Jordan. Rather than trying to make himself and his style like RJ, it seems like Brandon put himself into the heart of the saga and allowed himself to be its vessel and storyteller. The result is that this book is clearly and undeniably a novel which belongs to the Wheel of Time series. There were only a few times where I suspected the scene I was reading was entirely from Brandon's imagination. We may never learn which specific sequences he had to invent entirely, but in the end you probably won't notice or even care. It's pretty seamless in that regard. If you have read Brandon's other novels, you'll probably pick out pieces of text that phrase things in a way that sound more like his writing. Some characters' names sound like they might be from the Mistborn world rather than Randland, and some characters, for me, were not exactly as I pictured them. The strange thing about that, though, was that another person closely tied to the project said that they thought a certain character was off, and I thought that character was perfectly represented. On the other hand, characters I felt were different seemed to be spot on to that person. So, no matter what you say about it, you are going to bring your own experience and vision of each character with you, and whether or not you agree with their interpretation in The Gathering Storm is up in the air.
And then Jason continues, "The most obvious fact in all of this is that Brandon put his heart into this book. Even though it's a thick tome, none of it feels padded or rushed. Before he was the writer tasked with finishing this series, he was a fan like you and me. He clearly knows what fans like and dislike and has crafted a novel that primarily follows in the footsteps of its predecessor, while also delivering in a way that he knows will go over well with the crowds. And to be fair, a lot of that insight was probably shared by Robert Jordan as well. Knife of Dreams was a great book that had a lot of steam behind it. I am saddened by the thought that this part of the series will inevitably play out differently than if Robert Jordan were still with us. It's a loss that fans will always feel and wonder about. Maybe it could be loosely described as a wound that cannot heal. I suspect that Brandon himself feels much more keenly than most. However, after literally just a few chapters, I was reassured. Guided by a strong plot outline, familiar characters, and a knowledge of the franchise that was honed to a razor-sharp edge by lots of research, it became quickly apparent to me, or intuitively obvious to the most casual observer, that Brandon was the best person in the world to take this gig and that he did as fine a job as was even possible. For that, I am his biggest fan, until November 3rd at least, at which point you will be. In the end, though, I suspect that all thought of voice and different styles will fade away as you follow that familiar opening wind in Chapter 1. You'll reunite with these characters we've been following and once again become completely immersed in the struggles and adventures of this great saga. There's no doubt that The Gathering Storm deserves an equal place on your top shelf next to the previous 11 volumes. Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson have crafted a remarkable novel fraught with dark, forbidding themes that will remind you why you first fell in love with the series to begin with. Even though we know it's Brandon who pulled the actual worlds together, this is undeniably Robert Jordan's work and perhaps one of his best. Jason Denzel, jason@dragonmount.com. I'm really excited.
Excellent.
I can't wait.
Now, for those listeners of ours who haven't heard the rest of the news, Jason wrote this, the release date for The Gathering Storm was November 3rd. That has since been pushed up 1 week. The new release date is now October 27th. Mark it in your calendars, pre-order the book, do whatever you need to do. But make sure you get your copy.
Can't wait, can't wait, can't wait. Tuesday, October 27th. Woohoo, and
I actually already pre-ordered.
I've also confirmed that the unabridged audiobook will be available in the U.S. on the release day as well, which is really good news.
That, of course, begged a question for me. Did they ever actually release abridged audiobooks? Because it seems a little pointless to me.
No, and I hope they never do. I think abridged books are one of the largest abominations on the face of the earth, perhaps even in the entire universe.
What are abridged versions? Are they like summaries?
They just cut out large chunks of it. They try to just boil it down to its most basic parts, and it's usually like a quarter to a third the length of the entire book, or sometimes even less. I can't even imagine abridging one of Robert Jordan's books. It would just totally defeat the entire purpose.
Yeah.
To give you an example, if they abridged the first chapter of Eye of the World, not the prologue, but the first chapter, you would get Rand walking down the quarry road with Tam, and them getting into the village, with the sighting of the murderel. That is all. Any sort of description about what the land looked like, what the area around you, would be cut out.
Yeah, it would probably be boiled down to about less than a quarter of its actual length. And then they read it as though it were the regular, unabridged version of the book, and if you didn't know the book, you might not miss it. But if you had ever even read one of the books, I think listening to an abridged audiobook would be just absolutely, you know, ridiculous. It wouldn't satisfy at all.
So it's an audio version of Cliff Note.
Well, maybe a little bit more than that, but I just don't like abridged versions at all. Some people do. But personally, I don't. And I don't like short books. And I've actually become even less a fan of shorter books since I've started reading The Wheel of Time over and over and over again. Because now, I mean, even Lord of the Rings seems short to me. And I used to think that was like this epic tome.
And speaking of abridged versions, for those of our listeners who perhaps are spending their last few pennies on The Gathering Storm, or perhaps don't have the time to reread Knife of Dreams, Jason and Dragonmount have provided a nice little PDF with an abridged version of The Knife of Dreams.
And actually, if you want to have a synopsis of the entire thing up to a certain point, because it's an ongoing work, you could always go read Lee Butler's read-through of The Wheel of Time, which is being published as a blog on Tor.com. And as some of you will know, we just interviewed Lee Butler a few weeks ago and had a great time, unexpectedly great time. I think she wasn't quite sure and we weren't quite sure how it was all going to work out, but as Watt fans together, we all managed to find plenty to talk about. We had a lot of laughs, too.
Yeah, it's definitely a good time with Lee, and having read through the recap of Knife of Dreams, I'd have to say the people at Encyclopedia Watt and our people at Dragonmount.com did a wonderful, wonderful job following each character, where they were, the main points of what happened to them over the course of the series. Towards the very end, they actually break down an entire list of the Forsaken, who they originally were, whether or not they've died at any point in time, whether or not they have been reincarnated, what their new name is, if we know it, and what names they might have gone under as they were masquerading as other people. It was a really nice, concise way, if you're never quite sure, well, you know, how many of the males are still around, and, you know, which ones were balefired, and how did this happen? It was really nice to see.
Oh, yeah, and about Asmodean. I think we find out who Asmodean's killer was in this book, don't we? I've heard that.
It wasn't necessarily said that we got to know. In what Jason just said in his review of Gathering Storm seems to suggest that Asmodean's killer might be in some ways divulged. It was more of an intimation than a direct, yes, we get to know what happens to Asmodean.
Yes, but I've heard that from other sources that we do in fact get to know. I can't confirm that. I have to be mysterious, but I have actually heard that. We do hear that in this book, so we'll find out if that's true or not.
Oh, that's cool.
I cannot divulge my sources. Anyway, I don't know it for sure. Somebody could be just pulling my...
I have to add something. In Jason's review, he quotes Robert Jordan describing Rand's situation as the last round, the last 3 minutes. And I thought that the last 3 minutes was a really apt description for The Gathering Storm and the other two books, each one sort of like a minute of that last round in my imagination. I thought that was a really nice way of describing it.
Well, Robert Jordan was always fond of making boxing analogies, and if you remember some of his blogs before his untimely death, he was constantly referring to himself as in a battle with Sonny Liston or some other famous fighter, similar things, you know, where you take a punch, but you get up and keep going. And he was evidently fond of the sport of boxing, so I'm not surprised that he would liken Rand's situation to it, because, you know, Rand is really... Now, it's not going to take much to put him down for the count. I think at this point in time, he's as hard as he's made himself, I think he's still extremely fragile. And as Jason said, the Dark One's really not even been damaged yet. He hasn't taken anything.
And it gives the impression that Rand is only going to get harder in this book, which honestly is kind of a scary thought.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is that maybe he just gets so hard that he does something that shocks even himself back to reality, because honestly, I'd really like to see him... Maybe he can't go back to the kind of sweet, unaffected young boy that he was, but I think he can find somewhere a little bit in the middle from the cold, hard person that he's trying to make himself into, with probably questionable success in a lot of ways. I mean, he certainly still agonizes over all the things that he ever did before and will again.
He needs some kung fu zen calmness in him.
Yeah, or Yoda.
Lost your hand, you have.
To the dark side, you will turn. I knew you were going to do that. I just had to set you up for that.
Craft a new one, we will.
Y'all need to learn the lightsaber all over again.
That's one of the things I wondered about late in Knife of Dreams. Rand makes some sort of comment, just like an offhand comment of, well, shoot. He thinks that, you know, I'll have to learn to use the sword one-handed now.
No,
because a lot of the forms require two hands. And I'm sitting there thinking, when do you think you're going to have time to relearn to use the sword with your offhand?
Yeah, really. No, I think he said that to Bashir, didn't he? I'm going to have to learn the sword all over again. Yeah, I don't know. When is he going to find the time?
I remember because Min was completely shocked, and she kind of blurts out that... You know, that's exactly how he sees it. You know, he's lost a hand, he can't do anything about it, so he's just kind of put it behind him. And she's honestly, I think, frightened by it, because here's this person that she really cares deeply for, and she loves a great deal, and rather than raging or going through any of the typical emotions you would expect from having been so severely wounded, he just goes on with things and has the complete opposite reaction. Even past the point of shock, where it's like, oh no, I've acknowledged what's happened. I just don't have time to think about anything else.
Well, you have to realize that this is a guy who for the last, what, 2 years in Wheel of Time, has been readying himself, steeling himself, hardening himself, and inuring himself to the fact that he believes he's going to die. And he hopes that the prophecies indicate there's a chance that he can die and be reborn, die and live again, or as it says, but he's not sure about that. He's been making himself ready to die for 2 years. So losing a hand compared to death, it's like, yeah, okay, it's just one more step on the road.
Well, yeah, no, I get it. It just, I don't know, if for some reason that was one of those catch-my-attention scenes, I guess.
Yeah.
Quick point, which hand did he lose?
The left one, I believe.
Yes, Rand was left-handed.
He was left-handed? No, he just lost the left hand. I think he was right-handed. I think he just lost the left one.
There's, and I know it's a Knife of Dreams, because I was really surprised. He made comment about the fact that, I mean, that was the primary reason that he was going to have to relearn the sword, and that was because it was something about the dominant. I seem to recall there being something about him writing or something, too, and it was just really weird, because I was like, I didn't realize he was left-handed.
Well, you got me on that one. I just read Knife of Dreams, and I do not remember that at all.
Yeah, I didn't remember which hand he lost, but I'm looking for the cover now. I think they took off his right hand in the cover.
No, it's definitely his left
hand. No, it's in the left.
He's got that fold of his cloak over the left hand in the cover. I can see it clearly in my mind. That I'm sure about. I don't ever remember it saying in anywhere in the novels that he was left-handed. I just don't. I don't know that it said at all. I just assumed that he was, because most people are.
Gathering Storm cover covers his left hand. That's true.
And I would think that if he had been left-handed, it would have been mentioned, because most people that have to fight a lefty have to fight differently, and most lefties have to fight right-handed people differently. And I think they have to learn stuff differently, because they have to counter the attacks in a different way. And people get really locked into that. In fact, they'd even mention Trom, or was it B'Arr? I think B'Arr informed Galad that when he faced Eamon Valda, that Valda would strike from the right and expect it from him. And Galad thought that was an unusual weakness in a blade master, but handedness is very important in the sword. Very few people are ambidextrous enough to not be dominant in one side or the other.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Definitely.
Yeah, you definitely, I mean, even in martial arts, but I mean definitely with weapons, you do not fight somebody who's an opposite dominant hand than you in the same way that you fight a normal righty at all. You have to counter everything differently. I just think it would have been mentioned.
Okay, so then that begs the question, if I'm going to be carrying something like a scepter, which hand am I going to be carrying it in?
Your offhand. I would never be carrying a scepter in my right hand if I was a righty.
I guess it would depend, I mean, at least from my point of view, it would depend on whether you thought you would need at any point in time during this negotiation to draw your blade. Because...
Yeah.
If you're going to need to draw your blade, then obviously you're going to have your sword hand unlimbered. But if you're just being casual, you know, half the time people gesture with the things in their hands and that, and I could totally see it being one of those things where you'd be gesturing with this, you know, the scepter, particularly because it's a spearhead anyway and it's threatening and woo.
Woo. I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen a portrait of a king holding the scepter in the right hand. Almost all the ones I can think of that I remember which hand it's in the left. Because most people are right-handed, they keep the right hand free. I don't know. I could be constructing a tower out of nothingness here. Yeah, here it says, he said he's going to have to work out new ways to do everything because she starts to... He's got something in his right hand because he didn't have a left hand anymore, and he starts to take the crown of Ilion from men, but... And he kind of pulls it back and went, oh, I have to work out new ways to do everything, so...
See, here's the problem with that. If you look at the book covers for the second book and the third book, and even the fourth book, it looks like he's right-handed, because in the cover for The Great Hunt, his sword is on his left hip. That means he draws it with his right. In The Dragon Reborn, he reaches for Kalimdor with his right hand. And in The Shadow Rising, he's holding... the mug of ale while he's sitting on the wagon with his right hand, unless that's not him. He's always portrayed in the covers as right-handed, and I think it would be a pretty important detail.
Yeah, I just feel like Robert Jordan was enough of a weapons master that if Rand had been a lefty, it would have been mentioned in one of the fight scenes. You know, or at least one of the training scenes where he's working with Lon and all these other things. It's never, ever mentioned that Lon has to teach him any different way than... is typical for a right hand. I mean, let's face it, the vast majority of people, at least in our world, are right-handed. So the occasional lefty really is an oddity and has to just learn stuff differently. So I really think it would have been mentioned, at least during Lon's training, that he was a lefty or in one of the battles. But that's just my opinion. I guess, as Brandon says, unless Robert Jordan comes down in a white beam of light, sets us straight, we'll just have to speculate.
Okay, what's it say in the passage about having to relearn the sword? Does he have to relearn how to use it one-handed, or does he have to relearn how to use it with his other hand?
It mentions because most forms are two-handed, you'll have to relearn the sword.
So he could have easily been right-handed to begin with and just has to relearn certain form.
Yeah, here it is. Bashir says, at least you're alive, he said gruffly. I've seen men hurt worse. And then Rand says, me too. I'll have to learn the sword all over again, though. Bashir nodded. Most forms required two hands.
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean he was left-handed. It just means he's used to using two hands with the sword.
Yeah, if he's using a two-headed sword, that's what it's going to take. It doesn't say much about the size and the length and the weight of the sword that he does carry, only that it was a Heronmark blade, and I think, wasn't it Laman's blade? King Laman's blade that Avienda gave him, that he's still using? I wonder if it's the type of sword that can be used one-handed, or will he have to get a lighter one? Because, you know, a lot of the two-handed swords really aren't suitable for one-handed use.
I was always under the impression that the swords he and Lan uses and the one that she gave him, which was Laman's sword, that they were hand-and-a-half swords, that they could be used one-handed, but with an additional hand to aid.
Yeah, you're probably right. The two-handed is probably just a formality, basically, because it gives you more control.
Okay, here is a comment from what is called the Wheel of Time Compendium. Actually has some replicas of the various blades. It says one can even place the heron on the hilt with some accuracy if one assumes Rand is right-handed. He must be a left-handed swordsman, cannot make it through 6 books without comment. During his second confrontation with Baalzamun in the Great Hunt, Rand is marked with a heron on his right palm. He's been holding the sword before him in both hands. If right-handed, he would put his right hand above his left, closer to the crossguard, and thus would place the heron a few inches from the crossguard, on the right side of the hilt, the outward-facing side of the hilt when sheathed. So, yeah, coming from the fact that it was on his right hand first, it just probably comes down to the fact that a lot of the sword forms do require the left. And I think what threw me off is that Rand reached for the crown with his missing left hand, which seems a little odd to me too, in that I think in ways of the dominant hand being the one you're going to trust more, you know, I don't normally reach for things with my left hand unless they're specifically to my left side.
Unless you're a swordsman. And it mentions many times in the books, particularly about the warders, that they just don't encumber their right hand, or they're right-handed, for anything, unless they have to. And it even mentions it. They will frequently reach for things or pick up things with the offhand because they won't encumber their sword arm. I think even Viren mentions something about patting Tomas on the arm or touching him on the arm or something like that, or he does something back and she says he felt in no danger, or he would have never let his sword arm be encumbered even by that brief contact, something like that. Not sure that was Viren, but I think that's a swordmaster's move to pick up stuff with your non-sword hand. Because, you know, if you've got to draw in a hurry, you don't want anything in it. Where were you reading that quote? What website was that you read that from?
It is a compendium of weaponry and military costuming of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. The URL is kind of complicated. It is personal.arsdash-informatica.ca/paul/watt/watt.php?page=tam.
Well, I think I'll just Google it actually myself, but that's interesting. I hadn't seen that. I'll have to go check it out because that sounds really interesting, but I have to agree. I just don't think he could have gone through all those books as a lefty without some comment made on it. Just my opinion.
It's probably so, and just kind of one of those weird passages that shows up that, you know, sticks in my brain the wrong way.
I know, and doesn't that really reveal the depth of our geekiness that we can sit here and spend 20 minutes discussing whether or not our hero is right or left-handed? I like to geek out about stuff like this. I think that was one of the things that charmed me the most about Brandon when we interviewed him, is that he's completely and totally a Wheel of Time geek and can sit there and talk to you about the most tiny minutia. I mean, you know, we discussed Narg, for God's sake.
Who? Oh, that's the Trolloc who says hello to a wren in the Isle of the World.
Narg know her.
The one whose wife has hired Mogedion and that to be an attorney against Rand. Which I think it was Mesana, but anyway.
Wasn't Mogedion the shady investment counselor?
Yeah, she was the investment broker. No, I had made a joke in the What You Should Knows, the little short funny clips before the actual news, going through what the people were in the Age of Legends and how that transferred through. And I want to say it is probably Mesana now. It was something like a legal advocate or something like that. It was really weird, and I had basically said that it turns out that Narg's widow had contracted her to sue Rand for damages and loss of income.
Okay, I remember that now.
The Dragon Reborn had no comment.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're geeks. That's cool. Well, I would like to bring up one or two other points. What do you think is the big scene with Rand that happens? What do you think is the remarkable thing that happens to Egwene that nobody's figured out yet? I wonder what she chooses to do in the end.
I think Egwene gets in on the hunt for the Dark Friends. Maybe takes control of it. You know what, on second thought, that can't be, because in her views of the future, she never takes the oaths.
I don't know. He said it was Egwene who stole the show for me to describe what she goes through, what's revealed to her, and what she chooses to do in the end. Would be far too spoilerish to get into, but suffice it to say that it was dynamic and highly enjoyable. And he said and nobody was 100% accurate with the theories as to what happened to her on any of the blog posts that he read.
The Shan-Chan learn to travel. They get to the White Tower. Egwene and Lyowin shipless join forces, and from there I draw a blank.
Well, I think that was kind of obvious. I think we've all kind of agreed that that was a possibility, but maybe from what he's saying, it's not. I don't know. I just want to know what she chooses to do in the end. That's going to be a big surprise. Does she decide to walk away from being the Ammerlin Sea? Give it to Elida? No, that can't be.
She gets totally freaked out by something that she learns, and she decides that she's going to run. And where she runs is to the edge of Dragon Mount, and then some Shanshan comes up and says, hey, want to go to the top? And they decide to try to climb it.
And then they smooch.
Survey says,
Actually, I was going to suggest that they jump in, but, you know, that was just me being obliquely cruel for no apparent reason.
Yeah, poor Egwene. To describe what she goes through, what's revealed to her, and what she chooses to do in the end, that is extremely provocative. Jason, you're going to keep me up at night. And not in a good way. Now that's going to drive me crazy.
Isn't it, though? Shouldn't have read the spoilers.
Go away. Ugh. Oh, let's see. And Egwene's one of my favorite characters, so I have to be able to puzzle this out. I can't imagine what she would choose to do in the end, because she's so focused on becoming the Ammerlin Seed and healing the White Tower. It's hard to imagine what else she would choose to do besides that.
Well, since Jason said none of the theories were absolutely correct, it's hard to believe you're going to come up with one now just because you know that none of them were absolutely correct.
What if she runs off to become a Suldam?
See, I think it's too outlandish. Now, I could see it being something really weird, like something's revealed, like Elida has purposefully done stuff to endanger Gawain, and Egwene ultimately ends up choosing to forego being Ammerlin so that she can save Gawain.
I could see that. I could see her actually choosing to maybe kill Elida, too, and then walking away from the Ammerlin Seat for Gawain. But I'm not sure if that's novel enough that nobody's thought about it.
Didn't her dream say that she had to be approached and saved by one of the Shan-Chan in order for the White Tower to be whole and not be destroyed?
Well, I've always thought she's going to have to work with the Shan-Chan because of at least that one dream for sure, or viewing or whatever it was, and a couple of other things. I really thought that her aversion to the Shan-Chan was going to have to be overcome and that she would probably end up working with them because of that dream and a few other things. But still, maybe she'll go across the Arith Ocean and become Tuon's Aes Sedai advisor.
Well, it's actually two different dreams. The one about the White Tower being attacked is essentially there's a tall oil lamp pedestal-like thing that represents the White Tower, two ravens, which is the imperial sigil of the Shan-Chan Empire, fly by and sort of topple or totter the White Tower lamp, and little droplets fall on the ground and start their own little itty-bitty flames on the ground, which basically means that the White Tower is going to get somewhat scattered, but, you know, it doesn't actually fall over or break. And then the second dream was that Egwene was trying desperately to climb Dragon Mount. I mean, it doesn't actually call it Dragon Mount, but it was this very high mountain where bones were laced all around the ground and stuff, which I think they made mention of Dragon Mount slopes being littered with bones from people trying to climb it. And a Shan-Chan scrambles down to help her and grabs her hand and says, I think we can reach the top if we work together, or something close to that.
Yeah, those were the ones I was thinking about. One could interpret all the little droplets of oil almost being what's actually already starting to happen, where we have all these additional groups of channelers that are not really Aes Sedai anymore, but they're going to be affiliated with the White Tower. That doesn't necessarily figure in how the Shan Chan are going to be doing it, but maybe they precipitate some sort of schism or schism in the White Tower. But we've already got a lot of different people that Gawain and Elaine have already decided are going to be affiliated. You know, we got the Kin and the Sea Folk and all these other things, so maybe they are the ones that are represented by the little oil drops that are scattered and continue to burn. And apart from the scene that is so intense for Rand, which I'm almost afraid to start speculating about, the other one that was very provocative that Jason mentioned was, by the time you get to Matt's adventures to a certain location, I'm not saying a thing about where that might be, the theory forums and theory land will be bursting at the seams. Well, maybe this is all too obvious, but wouldn't that be the Tower of Genje?
I'm guessing as much.
That, or he just decides to, you know, take off and go after Tuan for no apparent reason.
Well, every apparent reason, they're husband and wife.
Yeah, but I mean, does he really want to go to Imperial Shanjin?
Don't think so. Not exactly Disneyland. Especially right now.
Or is it?
Hey there, Tuan! You have to go and sit on the Crystal Throne! Ha ha!
And so what's our plan tonight, Binky? Same thing as always. World domination.
Matt, I'm guessing something happens to change the plans, and the one other might be someone else other than whoever people have thought it was going to be.
Well, the conventional wisdom would be Tom, Matt, and Noel.
So what if Noel, something happens to him on the way?
What if it does? Then there won't be three of them and they'll fail.
Yeah. You always have Ulver.
No, she would have mentioned if it had been a boy. She said a man. I do not know.
She said one other. She didn't say a man.
I think she did. She said one other, a man I do not know, unless I'm very much mistaken, and I could be.
Please, the rate we're going, Ulver will be a man by the time he gets there.
Isn't that the truth?
Come on. From the beginning of Eye of the World to the end of Nights of Dreams has been 2 years.
Seriously? Long years, which somehow in our twisted scheme of things have taken 20.
I thought it's closer to...
No, we actually discussed this.
Yeah, we did discuss it.
No, that can't be. I mean, it's a year by the end of the Great Hunt.
No way.
Come on, Rand jumps 4 months into the future when he uses the portal stone.
That's not a year.
But he was in the Borderlands for a few months, and he keeps saying he's about a year having the sword.
He said it's less than a year since I was given the sword. He says I am less than a year old when he's asked in the Borderland fashion.
The first chapter of The Eye of the World begins in 998 New Era. Knife of Dreams ends in the late spring of 1000 New Era. So it's been just over 2 years.
Case closed. Thank you, Andrew.
Who wrote down those dates? Who decided?
Bob Klutz from the
Encyclopedia Watch.
That place. Thank you.
I have to have a little talk with Mr. Klutz there.
Nah, he's right. He's never been proven to be wrong so far, as that I know. We are making reference to the website www.encyclopedia-watt.org, which is a veritable fountain, a compendium, a fabulous resource of Wheel of Time information for anybody who hasn't visited it. I suggest you do it immediately. Anything you need to know about the Wheel of Time, you can probably find there, except who killed Asmodean.
This particular comment was also posted on DragonMount.com's Frequently Asked Questions page.
Mm-hmm.
I'm skeptical. I've always thought it was going to be Ulver, but I'm thinking now maybe it might be someone else who goes in with Matt and Tom.
Well, I don't think that Ulver will be one of the three. I am not ruling out the possibility that Ulver may have the idea and the possibility of following them in or going in after them, because he knows how to get in. He knows how to use the bronze knife and the words and the sign and everything, so he could tag along after them without their knowledge. But I don't think that he is going to be one of the three. original people. And we discussed that actually on our Eelfin and Aelfin podcast. It's one of the first ones I ever did, actually.
So what happens to Rand?
I don't know. Man, so much bad has happened to that cat already. I can't imagine what's going to be so horrible that it's going to look like, you know, you'll know it when you see it. It rocked him to read it. I'm going, oh my goodness, that's got to be something else. I can't even think. So many things have happened to him already. I can't imagine what could be worse. Except if he kills someone he loves, maybe.
I'm guessing Rand will choose to kill a woman. A woman. I don't know who, but he will make the choice and he will do it.
He'll kill Fael.
Semirug.
No, he'll kill Fael and Perrin will be all upset and...
Oh, please.
God, no, please.
What were you
That's doing? All we really need is three more books of Perrin whining.
No kidding. And then he kills Perrin because he whined too much. Or maybe Bashir.
Yeah, but then he'd have to kill himself.
Or maybe Bashir will. No, I couldn't.
Moraine comes back and Rand kills her.
Oh man, that would be horrible.
Whatever happened to the Borluland armies in like the Black Hills or wherever? They haven't been mentioned in forever.
They're not in the Black Hills, they're outside of Camelin. Traipsing around, heading toward Mirandy, where Elaine misdirected them that the Dragon Reborn might possibly be. They're still traipsing around.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, Elaine was going to use them to try to help convince some of the houses to fall behind her with the threat of another war, etc., 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 etc. In all that interminable story arc. And what about the grand coronation? Is this going to be like Princess Diana's coronation, you know, wedding, the reprise?
God, I hope not.
Or are they just going to be too busy to deal with all that?
I don't think the party's going to take place till after Tarmon Gaedon.
Well, for one thing, she's going to look a mess, what, 5 or 6 months pregnant, being crowned queen. And what is the cool sword stuff that Gawain's going to do? Okay, that's what I want to know. There was that one chapter where he, well, did some cool sword stuff. That was certainly engaging. Okay, well, that could be cool. Certainly Gawain's, I think, underestimated as a fighter because he's always comparing himself and being compared to his brother, Galad.
He's going to juggle.
He fights two Shan Shan with one arm tied behind his back. Literally.
Uh-huh.
He fights one Shan Shan with two arms tied behind his back.
Now you're being ridiculous.
Reminds me of the scene in Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. I'll kick you! I'll kick you!
What you gonna do, bleed on me?
But we didn't even get any crazy theories in. We need to do some crazy theories.
Leanne's a dark friend.
No.
She lied to Perrin in the Great Hunt.
She did not. She didn't lie to him. What did she lie to him about?
When Matt was sick, she told him he would be running around and he'd think that whatever, whatever, and something. And Perrin is, like, adamant. She lied to me. So I'm thinking maybe something there is, like, I'm getting suspicious.
I think that was hyperbole.
Probably.
She probably thought he'd be running around. She probably didn't realize how bad off he was.
Well, and also, he was slated for uber healing, and she has to have confidence in healing, regardless of what the situation is.
Okay, so anyway, that's our little read-through, in hoping that you haven't already read this. We've just wasted all your time, but that's our take so far on Jason's reading of The Gathering Storm. And again, I'm so jealous! I want it so bad. But okay, can't have it. Gotta wait. We'll move on.
Oh, we hope you've enjoyed the news in this relatively short but sweet podcast. As we are wont to say, that was What You Should Know.
And we hope that you will all return with us for next exciting episode.
Once again, we'd like to thank all of you for listening. And if you should like to get a hold of us, leave us a message or a comment, you can always do so on our phone lines or via the email.
You can always leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. You can also find us. We have a group page on Facebook and also a MySpace page. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is Fourth Age.
And most of us are, of course, fairly active, both in the Fourth Age forum on DragonMount.com and in the individual comments that follow each episode of the Fourth Age. A lot of us read through them all and post, some of us a little more frequently than others. But we definitely love hearing from everyone, and send us anything. Crazy theories, ideas, your own thoughts on what's going to happen. Criticisms, comments, you know, what you liked about last episode or the episode before that, you know, what you didn't like. Obviously, we always wanted to try to develop better and better programming for all of our listeners, and we enjoy discussing the Wheel of Time, and we want to know what you guys would like us to talk about.
That's really true, and if you are a regular listener, you will know that several times we have devoted an entire episode to listener emails. And or topics suggested by listeners. Our topic on Pat and Fane was suggested by one of our listeners, and we always give credit where credit's due. And there are other episodes which are still in the ubiquitous editing phase that will show up eventually, and you will see that we really do read all of the emails that we get. We read most of them on the air if we can. We try to include the voicemails as possible. We haven't really done that yet. Actually, the first episode that we did that had to be discarded because of severe technical issues in game, when basically one track went missing and was unusable, but we do have several others that we have going that will show up eventually.
Once again, thank you all for tuning in and listening. We hope you'll be listening when the next episodes come in.
That's right. Thanks, Samir and Andrew, for joining me tonight on this episode. We've had a great time, as usual. And we're all very excited about all the news in the Wheel of Time world, and we hope you are as well. And looking forward highly to the gathering storm. So this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Thilman Shima, Taishite.
I'm a podcaster and I don't care. I jump on the floor and I jump on the chair. Can't talk at all, my tongue is tied. And if you listen to this, your brains must be fried.
She's a lumberjack and she's okay.
I work all night and I sing all day.
Cut down trees, I wear high heels. Suspenders and a bra. I wish I was a girly just like my dear papa.
It's the Lumberjack broadcast of all time. And for myself, Andrew Gello, Sravya Ninto, Manshima Taishate. We'll just leave my rendition there. I'm sorry. I just always wanted
to... Stop that laughing!
I just always...
One of these days you're gonna die laughing!
What better way to go? I just always wanted to say Sravya Ninto, Manshima Taishate.
Oh ho ho, Suravya Ninto Manshima Taishite!